Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Endgame with my two co-hosts, because the third one is way past being a guest now, Mr. Bill Fleckenstein and Mr. James Aitken. Gentlemen, how are you? Bill, you first. How are you, mate?
I'm doing just fine, and I'm hoping both of you two wonderful mates are doing as well.
Is that my cue to cry a bit? I get a bit teared up whenever Bill says that.
Yeah.
A little bit. You've been on a tear this year. You have been all over the place this year. You've been hard man to pin down.
Well, if you mean all over the place in terms of travel, yes. Just to clarify, well, there's been a lot going on. There's a lot of people to have a chat with. There's a lot of people, more important, to listen to. It's been a quite confusing year in a lot of respects. Some things happening that are obvious, some things perhaps not. And if that requires me to get on a plane, so be it. But yeah, it'd be hard to top the amount of travel this year, and there's a little bit more to go. But you know, first world problems, right?
Let's talk about that at the top of the show. Let's talk about what you've heard from people and what you've been talking about. Because, you know, you talk to the smartest people in the world, and if they want you to come see them, it means there's someone important to talk about. So talk us through those conversations, the nature of them.
Let's see if we can frame some of this discussion at a very broad level. I think if the three of us were having a chat in January 2022, and we guessed that the Fed was going to jack rates up the way they did and at pace, other central banks, and that by late 2023, we're still not entirely sure if central banks are done, and the Fed in particular. Look, if we'd guessed that in January 2022, I reckon we would have penciled in much more obvious signs of a slowdown in consumption, rising credit stress, so wider spreads, more obvious and widespread defaults, a derating of the equity market, tighter financial conditions in general, and all in all, more signs of economic stress. And here we are. It's remarkable. And part of the journey for me, well, a very key part of the journey for me, I should say, over the past 18 months has been, okay, we know inflation's not transitory. We take central banks at face value. We know they're going to hike rates, but we know there's long and variable lags in monetary policy. But I need to be open-minded here. I need to unlearn things. I need to think differently about the world, if for no other reason than fiscal policy's all in. And as I think we said roughly a year ago when we had a chat back then, look, there's no great historical analogues for the present. You know, there's bits of the 70s, there's bits of the 60s, bits of the 80s and 90s and so forth. And if one wanted to be dramatic, oh, bits of the late 40s, et cetera. But there's no good coherent analogue. And I think critical to navigating this transition is having an open mind. I know that's a cliche. Being humble, I know that's another cliche. But most of all, unlearning things. And I think one of the key things people are struggling with is we thought we knew how monetary policy transmitted to the real economy. We get a little bit too much inflation. Labor market's a bit too hot. One or more central banks, e.g. the Fed, says, hey, we're going to move rates up. They talk a tough game. They keep moving rates up. Something breaks. They're forced to do a 180-degree turn. They start cutting rates. We end up at the zero lower bound. We know that game. Central banks can't follow through on their promises. Well, here we are in late 2023 with a Fed funds rate, let's say simplistically 5.5. The US consumer still in pretty good health. The stock market sort of churning around but going nowhere. Bond yields higher. Defaults rising a little bit. Credit spreads well-behaved and so on and so forth, certainly feels at a minimum that we need to revisit how we think we know monetary policy is transmitted to the real economy. So for me, first and foremost, it's all about unlearning. And look, just to simplify it a little, there's this great tendency, as we know, for people to project on various social media platforms and all their commentary on markets and investing is basically, I am right. And then when the three of us and many of our friends listening think about all the greatest investors and, frankly, all of the greatest traders we know, their mindset is always, am I right? And there's a huge difference between I am right and am I right? And I think it's the am I right approach that will continue to serve us well as we switch into 2024. So it's a nonstop learning journey for me, Grant and Bill, and things I thought I knew or understood, I've had to set them aside and learn and adapt and pivot as evidence comes in.
You know, the implication of what you're saying is there might be things that we don't know, and we're keying on some of the wrong things, which you'll get to. But I want to just put one other piece to the puzzle, because it's not really your department, but it's an important ingredient in the things that I think you're going to want to talk about, but seeing as how I read what you write. And that is the equity market. You know, you said, what would we have penciled in if we knew all this? We probably would have penciled in a lower equity market. And one thing I think we can't forget about is the size of the massive bid and its passive bid and its distortion. Obviously, that's Mike Green's department. But I think part of what you're going to discuss, if we layer in the fact that the stock market doesn't seem to care as much about important things that it used to, I think that's another factor that is leading people to be more wrong, because this is a new phenomenon over the last 15 years. So anyway, you might want to just touch on that when you go through your view of what things people might be missing.
Yeah, well, let's, as they say, double tap on that, because otherwise I might forget. Of course, you're right. And I would extrapolate it from passive. I'd extrapolate it into all forms of non-fundamental quantitative flow through global markets. And to be very clear to our listeners, it's not to complain or tilt at windmills or bemoan it. It's just to realize the environment we're all operating in. So there are hundreds of conversations like ours occurring today around the world, trying to figure stuff out, trying to be less wrong from a qualitative fundamental perspective. And, you know, you put macro and all of that. But the reality is that even if we all get it dead right upon the outlook, the road ahead and markets and so forth, even if we put our portfolio out perfectly, we're going to be a tiny, 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 tiny percentage of turnover in all markets around the world. That's the reality. We could be the greatest value stock investor in our chosen sector. But facts are, because we're such a small percentage of turnover, you know, maybe high single digits, the chances are as soon as we put capital to work, we're going to be instantly wrong, because the 90% is driven by non-fundamental strategies in the broader sense, whether they be passive or let's call them quantamental. And that's just the way it is. Now, whether it be vol targeting, passive, you know, we go down the list, all these gigantic factor engines. Look, effectively, they've all got an element of volatility targeting. So when implied volatility is falling, they add to risk. When it's rising, they start to trim risk all across all sorts of liquid markets. I think we all know that. And the point here, Bill, is that all this non-fundamental capital, which dominates global financial markets every day, it's very important to respect it. And it's very powerful within regimes. But if we're switching regimes or evolving into a different regime, then these non-fundamental flows or non-fundamental machines might not be well positioned and might be caught offside. And we see that from time to time when there's a sudden rush of flow that generally makes no sense as someone out there, non-fundamental, is recalibrating their exposures. So to be clear, we need to be mindful and respectful of the fact that there's an awful lot of people out there, frankly, who don't care. They don't care. And the essence of so much of that non-fundamental money, I mean, not so much passive, but the essence of so much of that non-fundamental money is that you can predict realized volatility and you can predict correlations. And if you can predict those two things, then you could construct a very large portfolio of exposures all around the world in most liquid markets that you can control pretty tightly, which is what happens. And that's just the reality. So for me, look, we could call it a distortion. I'd agree with that, but it's not going to change. It's not going to change. It's going to be with us for a long, long time to come. And I think the real challenge for all these non-fundamental strategies is if we ever arrive at the point where we have a proper hard landing, a proper default cycle, and inflation is still too high.
James, that's so interesting, right? Because it feels to me like we're either there or we're very close to that, right? We are seeing defaults pick up. Defaults are at a really high level now. the chance of a hard landing, let's put that aside because everyone's, you know, there are still people talking about this no landing scenario, which, okay. And this idea that if you can predict those two things right, you can build very large portfolios. Again, yes, until you're wrong, in which case you've got massively large portfolios, which are inherently much more risky when you try and unwind them. So it feels like we're setting up to a point where the things you just talked about matter. They're very quietly starting to happen. Inflation is still too high. And yet we haven't had that moment yet, that kind of Wile E. Coyote moment where gravity takes hold. From a purely market perspective, is there anything that you've either seen or anything that you've talked about in these meetings with people that, passive aside, helps explain why we are seeing activity on the bond market, which you would think generate a negative response in the equity market? In fact, I think Barclays came out last week and said, what the bond market really needs is an equity crash. That's the only thing now that can save the bond market. None of it makes any sense because all the building blocks are there except maybe one or two. And it doesn't feel like anyone's looking at that pile and going, wow, there's only one or two building blocks needed. I should get ahead of this.
Just on your opening point, once upon a time, we used to say nobody goes broke owning IBM. And I suppose these days, if you wanted to be a little bit cheeky and imagine a quantamental driven world or factor machine driven world, I guess you'd say these days nobody goes broke being overweight growth versus value. In other words, what does conventionally wrong mean versus my peers? Once upon a time, well, you know, I could take all sorts of fancy bets in tech, but hey, I think I better just have IBM. And I wonder if these days it's like, well, I could do all this fancy stuff, but hey-ho, if growth versus value reverses, everyone's going to be wrong, so that's okay. But your broader question, I think, is the really interesting one. And file what follows under what am I missing? And think about the past 25 years, and I'm going to focus on the US, but it applies in some other countries, just to sketch a scene here. We had 24 years through 2019, where in the US you had nominal GDP of about 4, you have an inflation slash deflator of about 2, which meant you had real GDP about 2. Now, we had some deviations from that, most famously in 2008, of course, but basically we were in a lowish growth, lowish inflation, or predictable lowish growth, predictable disinflation type of world, and people adjusted to it. So we focused on real GDP, which makes a lot of sense in a lowish growth, lowish inflation world. It makes perfect sense. And then, of course, in the fourth quarter of 08, or really 08 and as a whole, nominal GDP in the US didn't fall from 4 to 2 to 0, it went negative. And as every listener knows, when negative, when nominal GDP is negative, there's nowhere to hide. It's absolutely brutal. Aggregate demand obviously has collapsed. Defaults are rising, people out of work, there's a credit crunch. We know how it plays out. Now let's fast forward to 2020 and then 2021. As a result of the full-throated fiscal policy adopted not just in the US but everywhere, nominal GDP in the US shot up to about 15%, which is just mental. And 15% nominal GDP, everything works, particularly if a central bank is committing to holding rates at zero. And we had the reaction we had, which made a lot of sense. And nominal GDP has been coming down and coming down and coming down. And through the quarter just ended, it's probably going to realize at about 7 or 8% still, despite everything. Now, that's made me think for the best part of 18 months, okay, are we in a lowish growth world or are we in a somewhat higher nominal demand world because fiscal policy is all in and inflation is far from a finished business? Maybe it pays literally to pivot a little from the focus on real GDP to nominal GDP. But again, frankly, through a very thick frog of Bundy and Coke, and as a frequent visitor to Australia, Grant, you'll know what I mean, through a thick fog of Bundy and Coke at university, I vaguely remember in the back of some macroeconomics textbook that if a fiscal authority was all in and running very large budget deficits, then nominal GDP was likely to be quite high. And there we are. So there's the big question of so what? Well, nominal GDP in the US is coming down, but it still seems to be well above anything we experienced over the last 24, 25 years, or at least through to the end of 2019. And if nominal GDP is going to be mid-single digits, let's say 5% or 6%, which is probably what it's tracking through the fourth quarter, then frankly, bills get paid. If nominal GDP is 5 or 6%, then the economy as a whole is probably going to be generating more than adequate cash flow to service all its debts. And quite frankly, the best run businesses, yeah, as a result of high discount rates, they might, their multiples will decompress. We know that. But in a world of 5 or 6% nominal GDP, the best businesses and the best executive suites will still find a way to generate satisfactory earnings and perhaps outrun the multiple compression from higher rates. And I know there'll be some listeners saying, oh, geez, is that a bit of reverse engineering, trying to understand what's happened? Well, perhaps yes. But I've been trying to think for, well, 15 months now, what am I missing? What do I need to unlearn when fiscal policy is all in? So the first point is that I wonder if we'd be better advised to focus on nominal GDP as opposed to real. And then the second point is, yes, so much of this is reflexive to fiscal policy, but let's think about what we did during COVID. We did what we were told was impossible, which was direct fiscal transfers to households and businesses. So Uncle Sam went deeper into debt, transferred money to households and corporations, which boosted the income of households and corporations, allowed them to deliver, and allowed them to term out their debt. And this, I think, is the crux of why this time seems different. Not this time is different, this time seems different or feels different, because the elasticity, if you will, of the US economy in particular to a much tighter Fed seems to be a lot different, which makes perfect sense because households have termed out their funding on average at low rates. Corporations have termed out their funding at average lower rates. But of course, there's one giant borrower that hasn't termed out its funding adequately, and that's Uncle Sam. So look, just to recap there, maybe we need to think a little bit more about nominal GDP as opposed to real GDP. We need to think of the fact that household balance sheets in the US are in great shape in aggregate, because let's face it, financial policy is not set on the basis of anecdotal demand. We all have anecdotes about how things are breaking or falling down. It's aggregate demand. Household balance sheets in aggregate, good shape. Corporate balance sheets in aggregate, in good shape. Will there be people who fall through the cracks and get into difficulty in this, that, and the other? Absolutely. Is the US economy slowing at the margin? Yes, it is. But it's slowing from extraordinary high level of nominal demand to what is still appears to be an above trend level of nominal demand. And when you think about that, you think about fiscal policy, you think about balance sheets, as mad as this sounds to listeners, and I know as mad as it sounds to most of my clients, as much as the Fed seems to have done, as much as other central banks seem to have done, it's still not obvious to me that monetary policy is sufficiently restrictive. And frankly, I never thought I'd say that, but there we are.
But that also presupposes that money supply alone can fix the problem that money supply created when you've got this fiscal machine running, right? All I'm saying is no one knows what the right rate is. They may have gotten to it, they may not.
Look, I think, Bill, I'd phrase it a little bit differently. Let's just set aside the macroeconomics. Let's describe what's happening in blunt terms. We're searching for the wrong number. We're searching for the wrong Fed funds rate. We're searching for the wrong nominal 10-year note yield, and especially we're searching for the wrong 10-year TIPS yield. There's a wrong number up here somewhere where the consumer just says, I'm done, thanks for having me. Or corporations say, you know what, I need to right-size, which sounds so much better than sacking people en masse, you know. And we're mindful of lags. We're mindful of the cumulative impact of all these hikes. We must be. But really, the way I think about it is we're looking for the wrong number. And I'm not sure we've found it.
James, you talked there about the one big elephant in the room that hasn't termed out its debt, which is obviously Uncle Sam. You know, there's $7.6 trillion to roll over in the next 12 months. And you look at what that's going to cost as a percentage of tax receipts, it's extraordinary. And the rate of change of that percentage of tax receipts getting consumed by interest cover is insane. The chart will give you whiplash. What can they possibly do at this point? Because I think we all sit here and say, let's forget the economy for a second. Whether you're in the equity market, if you're a corporate treasurer, if you're Uncle Sam, you know that the only thing that's really going to bail you out are rates coming down. Uncle Sam needs them coming down. Corporate treasurers need them coming down. The equity market needs them coming down. We all need that. And then you go, right, okay, we all understand that's what we need. Now, GDP, 7%. Something has to give somewhere. And I just go backwards and forward trying to figure out what it is. And I keep coming back to your point, to the fact that the Fed, the Treasury, the government are in a massive hole here. And if they can't dig themselves out of that hole somehow, how are the others going to be able to do it?
Well, the irony is that implicit in your question, which is a question I get a lot, and it's the right question, but implicit in it is, don't we need a recession? And I know that sounds brutal and very cold, but you know, when you look at the fiscal dysentery in the United States, and I apologize to anyone who's listening eating dinner, but it's fiscal dysentery. And there's no prospect of fiscal restraint or austerity or anything like that. And realistically, the only thing that might serve to get bond yields down, I mean, the Barclays people are possibly not wrong. Something goes wrong in the equity market, or frankly, growth slows for some reason, but it's not obvious where and how. The thing that's worrying me when you look at the world, especially this past week and a half, is not just the cost of servicing the total stock of US debt in public hands. It's not that. It's the cost of servicing that through time versus the US defense budget. Because I think when we look at the world, the US defense budget is not going down. We've probably got a supplementary budget coming from Biden out of necessity for Ukraine and given what's happening in the Middle East. And there's another $100 billion to be financed by somebody, right, or be bought by somebody. So the debt burden's not going away, but you think about longer-term implications of US debt servicing costs being greater than US defense spending or the defense budget, and then you think about how sustainable that is. That's the thing that worries me a lot more. And I know people talk about financial repression, and I think it's dead right to keep that on our radar. And if I may paraphrase, financial repression implies that we are compelled to buy things we don't really want to buy. That's financial repression. And if we get squeezed into them and earn a negative real rate of return over a long period of time, that's financial repression 101. But there's an intermediate step here when it comes to owning government bonds. It's perfectly rational for people to put as much money as they think is sensible into T-bills right now. I mean, we're in a complicated world, and for the first time in a long, long time, we're actually paid to wait. Now, that doesn't deal with the question of who's going to buy the rest of the curve. But the point there is a little bit like we've seen here in the UK, only a little bit. There is a number out there at which it's rational for US households to say, actually, T-bills are right. I might go a tiny bit further out the curve and so on and so forth. But that price, given the dysfunction in Washington, the price that US savers in general will demand to say, you want me to underwrite the curve? Okay, give me a higher coupon. It's probably higher than what we have today. So I'm just saying, I think there's an intermediate step where it's actually rational for US savers to say, you know what? At that coupon, I will take treasuries. But we're a long way from that. And before we all leap to yield curve control again, which is on everyone's mind, are we at the end of the day, the Fed's going to do the Treasury Fed Accord all over again and lock the curve down? I think there's an intermediate step where some people might find treasuries attractive, but we're a long way from that. I know I keep saying it. But then there's important spin outs of all of this. You know, again, macro 101, there's an old term we haven't had to think about for a long, long time, which is crowding out. And classically, if a government's going to borrow an awful lot of money, as far as the eye can see, that's going to crowd out other forms of investment spending. And if savers are going to take down, particularly domestic savers, more and more treasuries of various duration, then that means that savers are not going to be investing in other things. Now, of course, in parallel with all of this, the hurdle rate for every alternative investor has gone up a lot. The irony is that, as Bill knows well, all this money that do-gooders and virtue signalers threw at the energy transition, well, when interest rates are at zero, the cost of the energy transition is effectively nothing. when the Fed funds rates are 5.5, the cost of the energy transition and all these extremely speculative projects is a lot higher, and a lot of them are not going to make it. But then really, when we go back to the other part of your question, which I hadn't forgotten, we could have made an argument for much lower treasuries, much higher bond yields in the US for most of the past year. We all knew about a full employment budget deficit higher than we've ever seen. We knew that certain long-term holders of treasuries were no longer as enthusiastic. We knew that the US economy seemed to be doing a lot better. In other words, we knew. I think the surprise is that it took until this summer for the bond market to crack a bit, and it's only cracked a bit. And I think that the supply situation has a fair bit to do with that. Now, there's many acquaintances of ours who have been in markets for a long time, and what they thought they'd learned over their long careers is that government bond supply creates its own demand. Now, there's something to that. Let's just think about that. Because in previous economic cycles, you had generally more budget discipline. I know this is a sweeping statement, but let's go with it. You had full employment budget deficits that were a lot lower than the United States sees today. And at full employment, with your budget balanced, so to speak, you're seeing much higher tax revenues. Fiscal transfers are coming down. As the economy slows, the bond market responds. You're issuing coupons to underwrite demand, right? The fiscal authority, the bidders come in because the long-term owners of government bonds say, okay, the cycle's turning. I need more defensive assets. I'm happy to take that coupon for 20 years. So the point there is, for the last 40 years broadly, government bond supply created its own demand, but then again, you had much lower full employment budget deficits.
And one other important thing, mate, at least I believe is important, you commented, we had a positively sloped yield curve.
There you go.
It makes it much easier to rationalize a little extra supply and a little of this when you're getting positive carry. We haven't seen a negatively sloped curve of any consequence since the 80s.
And look, there's a whole bunch of things that are happening here that we put that in the folder this time seems different or feels different. The elasticity of US private sector balance sheets to Fed tightening, which I think is confounding the Fed as well. Fiscal policy being where it is. A lot of coupon supply to come. I mean, it's been so many years. I don't think of the number, I'll guess 25, 30 years, since we're all focused on the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee. What are they recommending for where they're going to issue all these long-dated bonds? How are markets going to digest it? But there's something much more simple than that that may tend to explain a fair bit or even a lot of what's happening in Treasuries in particular. For a long, long time, we have benefited from price-insensitive buyers of Treasuries or up and down the curve, any amount, indiscriminate buyers, whether we go back to China accumulating Treasuries and let's not forget agency mortgage-backed securities. It wasn't about price. It was about quantity. And similar could be said of a vast number of reserve managers evolving from the Asian crisis of 97. Oh, gosh, I need more liquid assets. Treasury is the answer. It's not about price. It's about quantity. We throw our friends in Tokyo on top of that, and we'll obviously come to them. You know, you had a lot of buy, hold, forget investors in Treasuries, not to mention the biggest of them all, which is the Fed. And all of those indiscriminate buyers have gone for now. They may not be gone forever, but they're gone for now. The Fed, as we know, is a net seller, or at least trying to advertise they're a net seller via reducing the assets they hold in the system open market account. We know that other reserve managers are net sellers of Treasuries. We know, subject to the evolution of Japanese rates, that the incentives have changed for Japanese savers. So those indiscriminate buyers of Treasuries are largely absent, meaning that the market clearing price is left to primary dealers at auction or pension funds or, frankly, domestic savers. Now, historically, there's always been a pension fund bid for US Treasury duration to match their liabilities. They've always been around. But the idea that US defined benefit pension funds are all going to come in and support Treasuries in a way that these other indiscriminate buyers did, I think that's wishful thinking. So they'll be there. They'll be buying this.
Without coercion.
Yeah, but I mean, on the one hand, if I'm a pension fund with a funding ratio above 100%, you know, I'm probably strongly incentivized to lock my balance sheet down and buy the long bond and just put a ribbon on top and say, thanks for having us. But the point is that if it's not pension funds and it's not yet the Fed and it's not these other people for a while, again, the market clearing price that US savers in general and US households might demand to own longer duration treasuries, I don't think it'll shock anyone to say that the yield, the risk premium they demand will probably be a lot higher. So we're on a journey here. We're on a journey. But while I remember, I've had versions of this conversation with my clients for 12 months and especially the last 6 months. And people say, oh, you're so bearish. Well, like everything in finance, it depends. You know, this is a timely reminder that the two best answers we can give to most of the topics we're wrestling with in finance or economics are, it depends, or I don't know. And on my recent travels, I had the good fortune to bump into a couple of denizens of the Salomon Brothers trading desk at the early 1980s. Some great stories. But I was giving them my spiel about nominal GDP and all of this, and I see them both starting to smile. I say, what's going on? They said, look, our rule of thumb back on the desk back in the day was that eventually a 10-year note would converge with nominal GDP. Ah. So if I'm saying, as I did earlier, that nominal GDP in the US is still somewhere between 5 and 6, doesn't it make sense if we're dusting off historical analogs that a 10-year note clears, if you will, somewhere between 5 and 6 before we consider the fiscal situation and everything else? In other words, as much as people are predisposed to saying higher bond yields equals bad, and to be clear, at some point there's a wrong number, I'm just not sure we're there yet. Might it be more a case that the bond market is finally catching up to the reality of nominal GDP that is still higher than anything we've seen for a long, long time? That's what I'm wondering, okay? And what is so interesting to me, just to not overcomplicate it, just to look at the screen, this bond market trades so poorly. It tries to rally, falls apart like a bad meatloaf, tries to rally again, grinds higher, falls down. We've got the coupon issuance to come. It trades really badly. And I keep meeting people who are trying to buy the bottom, trying to bet on a bottom, and they have been for a long time, and that's cool, you know, to each their own. But I see very few, I meet very few, I know very few people who are short, outright short bonds. And just to make it more relevant and interesting for our listeners, two of the people I've met, well, I know very well, who have seemed to have done best from the little crack so far, and let's be frank, it is a little crack, not a big crack in bonds, are two old school yet invisible macro traders who were just looking at their charts, looking at their numbers, looking at all their commentary, talking about recession and why bonds are cheap, and they're just looking at the numbers and like, well, if these things are so cheap, why do they keep leaking every day? And that was 6 months ago. So sell some. Oh, hang a minute, they're still leaking. Sell some more, and off we go. And the reason they keep pressing their bond shorts is very simple, because their P&L tells them they're right.
Well, you know, as an anecdote to your anecdote, mate, because I was buying bonds back in that period, we ran equities and balanced accounts, but you know, it's the balanced accounts we bought bonds. The rule of thumb used to be, I know this sounds quaint, that bond yields, and we're going to come up with roughly the same answer, long rates should be the inflation rate plus 3%.
There you go.
And that's another way of triangulating. You get to roughly the same number that the nominal GDP gets to.
Yeah. I'm not sure we've hit the wrong number. It kind of makes sense that bond yields are going up. And I think there's two points I'd make about bonds in the broader sense. And obviously, I'm focused on treasuries in this discussion. That markets rarely bottom when everyone's looking for a bottom. And the price action, I just look at the Bloomberg every morning. I look at the tick charts just to, you know, take the temperature of things, and they trade really soggy. They trade soggy despite everything. And there'll be all these people doom and gloomers saying a 5% long bond or a 5% 10-year note or even 10-year tips, which we might talk about in a sec, at 2.5 or maybe the high 2% range is some kind of dino-killing asteroid. Okay, maybe, but maybe we're just, the bond market's finally catching up with reality. I remember, Grant, the world worked pretty well in the 80s. Okay, bond yields were coming down, but there's tremendous volatility in 1994 in the treasury market and bonds and so forth in particular. And we seem to, you know, muddle through all right.
On the other hand, the level of the debt to GDP and the deficit to GDP are radically higher now than they were in the early 80s when rates were really high.
Completely right.
So that makes it a little trickier.
So I don't think it's terribly controversial to suggest that the market clearing price of longer-term treasuries could, for a vast number of reasons, turn out ultimately to be a lot higher than what prevails today.
Isn't that, in essence, the problem here? Is that you're right, it's absolutely, ceteris paribus, not remotely controversial to say that, based on everything you've just so eloquently laid out. However, that is a problem for so many people, the way they're positioned and the way they've been reinforced to act under certain market circumstances, that whether it's controversial or not doesn't change the fact that it's a problem.
You know, every day we see this pitched battle over the next 10 basis points in core PCE. I mean, it's great for eyeballs perhaps, but it's like, why are we obsessed with the next 10 basis points in core PCE or three-month annualized? You know, people go on and on and on. You know why? They're trying to pick the bottom. Oh, this is it. This is the turn. This is the US consumers tapping out. Well, I'm sure I speak for many of us when I say anyone who goes to the United States and gets outside finds it difficult to believe that the US consumer in aggregate is tapping the map. In fact, it's the opposite. Let's just on that, and I don't want to lose your thread about the pain potentially to come in bonds for some people, but imagine the year of a US household who termed out their mortgage 2 years ago, because they knew before any clever central banker that inflation was non-transitory. They turned out their 30-year fixed at 2-point-something%, happy days. Both parents working, kids in school, both parents enjoying satisfactory wage gains. Maybe they get paid $250,000 each. They've largely paid down their car and their house has never been worth more. Do you think they've been paying any attention whatsoever to the next 10 basis points in core PCE, let alone the Fed? They don't care. They don't care. All of this has passed them by. And that speaks to one of the conundrums that all of us in markets are wrestling with. This time feels different, maybe because private sector balance sheets, as intended, are in better shape. Maybe, in fact, to their own surprise, the Fed's got more work to do. We shall find out. Now, your broad question on bonds, we could take it in a number of different directions. The assumed predictable correlation between stocks and bonds in the first instance. In the second instance, people reluctantly deploying higher discount rates, both nominal and real discount rates, to value cash flow producing assets. What we need in terms of real yields to underwrite consumption and keep bringing forward consumption for the future. All of those things are up for grab right now. But again, I don't think anything we've discussed thus far is particularly controversial. It just seems to me that an awful lot of people are trying to predict a bottom in bonds or a turn in the US economy, which will come at some point. And I think we have more to go in terms of policy rates and bond yields. And you know what? It's going to be a difficult journey, but I'm not sure it's automatically the end of the world.
No, I agree with that. Well, listen, let's be controversial. And you know, there's a subject that's always controversial, and that's Japan. And we've touched on it a couple of times. We've talked about yield curve control. We've talked about financial repression. We've talked directly about Japan. So let's go there, James, because it's something that the three of us have kicked around, I think, in each of your previous appearances on The Endgame. We've talked about Japan. I think we all understand how important it is what happens in Japan, never mind what's happening in Japan. I think we've all looked at Japan as kind of the vanguard of this the vanguard with a lowercase v of this particular era.
So, I think, can I just interrupt you? I'm sorry. Can you please refrain from using the word vanguard because you might upset Bill?
I did hastily make sure you said it wasn't with a capital V.
I know. Just say, how about we ditch vanguard and say
it's the Black Rock.
No, stop it. Stop. No, it's at the forefront of change.
Okay, fair enough. So, trigger warning. We'll put a trigger warning in the transcript, Bill, don't we?
It's as long as we're talking about Japan, this is our cycle's version of the carrot sue that allowed prices to get so goofy in Japan in 1989. But we don't need a complex karitsu, if I'm pronouncing it right, We just need a couple of these entities. It's a decent segue to Japan anyway.
Yeah, I didn't know you spoke German, mate.
I thought you had a cold. I was going to say, bless you. So, James, let's talk about the Bank of Japan, because I can't imagine for a second that in your conversations the subject hasn't come up early in most of them, because it's so important. What's your current understanding? I think the last time we spoke was right after they've widened the band, if I'm right, for that first time. They've been under constant pressure since then. Well, give us your take on the BOJ and where they are right now.
Look, let's be frank. We had a conversation about yield curve control in Japan, possible adjustments to it, et cetera, given the evolution of the Japanese economy. I reckon it was in the second quarter of last year. And the rough logic was, let's keep an eye on this. It's not that the JGB market's going to fall apart. It's just like, we need to keep an eye on this because Bank of Japan JGB purchases were the global suppressant of term premium, which is just a fancy way of saying so huge were the Bank of Japan's JGB purchases that they suppressed long-term bond yields everywhere, as intended. So if anything ever changed there, we needed to be mindful because there might be some consequences for long-duration government bonds around the world. So that was why we had a chat about it. And just to reflect a bit, I was of the view that if they did make adjustments to yield curve control, it could have a powerful impact on the yen, which I realized was completely wrong. As classic, check the fine print. Well, if Japanese long-term government bond yields are going up a bit and US government bond yields are going up a lot more and nominal GDP in the US is still above trend, it's really hard for the dollar to go down. So a bit of a miss there on my part. And then Kuroda delivered and then Kuroda left. And make no mistake, the Ueda-san was employed to bring change to the Bank of Japan. And we all know, as does every listener, that Japan is a consensus-driven society. Nothing happens in a rush. But just fast-forwarding to the present, there is something profound going on in Japan that merits our collective attention. And it's not so much about yield curve control. And if I'm eyeballing my Bloomberg today, the beta or beta for our American friends of 10-year JGBs to 10-year treasuries is less than one. In other words, it's treasuries that are driving JGBs, not the other way around. Let's be clear about that. But the discussion now in Japan is not about JGBs per se. They will clear where they need to clear. The discussion in Japan is not, as they've been trailing, about moving away from minus 10 basis points negative interest rate policy back to zero, which is absolutely absurd when you look at the evolution of the Japanese economy today. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. And to be fair to Ueda-san, the governor of the Bank of Japan, there's a reason he's giving these interviews as he did 1 month ago to Muri Shimbun. There's a reason that every major Japanese bank CEO is saying, hey, you know, I don't think we need negative interest rate policy anymore. That's bloody obvious. There will be many people listening and say, why should we care if Japanese interest rates are going from minus 10 to zero? I mean, honestly, who cares? Is it going to massively alter the direction of dollar yen? No. It might at the margin, but generally, no, unless and until the US economy slows and US yields come down, et cetera. And we're absolutely certain the Fed's done. But this is not what this is about. This is about a Bank of Japan attempt at normalization. And it's not about policy rates going from minus 10 to zero, subject to the satisfactory evolution of Japanese wage negotiations. And to put a number on it, if Japanese wage negotiations, as we move into next spring, they come in the high 3% range again, that would give the Bank of Japan the comfort to forecast that inflation expectations are going to be well anchored again at 2%, that Japan has exited disinflation. And I don't think anyone has on their bingo card Bank of Japan hiking cycle. And that goes back to one of those phrases I love to deploy, which is beware the stable variable. And I think the ultimate stable variable underpinning so many careers and the way so many people think about the world is that interest rates in Japan are nearly always zero. And I think there's a rising probability that Japan is going to start or attempt a normalization cycle. It may not be apparent until spring next year. In fact, I think that's the most likely time. To be clear, I think the end of negative interest rate policy can happen at any time, and they're going to wait a little bit. But Japan hiking cycle in a sentence or even as a thought bubble is very different. And I think that's coming. Now, it doesn't mean that they go from 0 to 25 to 50 or some kind of Fed-like hiking cycle, but it is probably fair today, Bill, to say that the Bank of Japan is as far behind the curve now as the Fed obviously was the best part of 2 years ago. And again, to recap, given that the Bank of Japan, via their gigantic asset purchases, was the global term premium suppressant, the long-term bond yield suppressant of all, we need to be mindful of this. And I don't see how, if the Bank of Japan is going to embark on a hiking cycle, and it's implicit in what I'm saying, that if they find the way to take policy rates from 0 to 50 to 100, let's say the Bank of Japan shockingly can take policy rates up to 100, then the implication is that a 10-year JGB is not at 80 basis points or 100, it might be 150, 200. And if that's roughly right, then I don't see how anyone can be confident of a bottom in treasuries. So we need to watch Japan. There's a lot happening there.
And so given as how you said, or you implied, that it's really the FX market that's driving this thinking on their part, now we're knocking on the door 150. I think I know that you feel that somewhere around 155 could be a line in the sand. You want to talk about that? Because they might get their hand forced a bit by the FX market, possibly, or is that not naive to think that?
Well, Kanda-san, who's the Ministry of Finance's point person on FX, actually said as much during the week. You know, maybe we have to adjust interest rates to stabilize the yen. No kidding, mate. The thing that I find a bit interesting is that Japanese authorities, monetary and fiscal, if you will, if you're going to call MOF fiscal, which you probably should, they've been very consistent over the past couple of months. And it's been a long time since the market digested Bank of Japan speeches. I mean, you know the thousands of people who focus on Fed speeches, minutes, and everything else. It's been a long time since those sorts of things were material for the Bank of Japan, but now they are. But you look at what these guys are saying, it's really consistent. You look at the public statements of those bank CEOs. You look at the Ministry of Finance saying, hey, you know, maybe we need to do this. I mean, how many clues can these people drop that change is coming? And there's been a bit of a repricing in short-term yen rates, you know, after 2 years, 1 year, 1 year yen swaps and stuff like that. There's been a bit of repricing, but the market is very far from pricing the probability of some kind of attempted hiking cycle. And to be clear, not policy rates going up to, say, 50 basis points, but maybe double that, subject to the evolution of the Japanese data. But there's something more important, as you both know. There is a very consistent briefing campaign going on behind the scenes with some very important Japanese financial officials right now. It's been occurring for the past 2 months. I found it quite surprising when I met a particular gentleman here in London the other day, expecting him to be extremely dovish. How wrong could I be? And the language they're using when they're out and about in the Far East, in London, and even New York, is change is coming. And I don't think they're bluffing.
James, just help people understand what the world looks like, how the dominoes fall if the Japanese do embark on a tightening cycle. Because we may get that little period where, as you say, they get back to zero and people go, it's a nothing burger. They go to 25, people go, well, that's it. They're done now. They can't go any higher. Like we all thought the Fed would be if they got to, you know, 1, 2, 2.5, 3. And then there's this suddenly, oh, shit moment when people realize, Christ, they're serious. And now people refuse to believe how serious they are. What does the world look like where the Bank of Japan get the bit between their teeth and say, no, no, we're going?
Well, to be consistent and to be very clear, as with everything, it depends. It depends why the Bank of Japan's hiking rates. And just to flesh it out a bit, the late Prime Minister, Mr. Abe, embarked on long overdue corporate reform, shareholder governance reform in Japan, shockingly, to try and transform a lot of very, very sleepy Japanese businesses into shareholder-friendly businesses, returning capital, et cetera, et cetera. Kishida-san, who's an almost accidental prime minister and, let's not forget, former banker, is determined to finish that job at a time when he's deeply unpopular. So it's trying to reignite the equity culture that Japanese households last enjoyed 40 years ago when you know, there was one seller of Japanese equities named Bill Fleckenstein and everyone else was the bid. Is that right? That's roughly right, Bill, isn't it?
That's about right.
Yeah, that's why I have these scars across my back.
That's right. That's right. It's basically Bill versus Mrs. Watanabe in a cage match.
Well, it wasn't so much Mrs. Watanabe. She didn't help much. But it was those damn Koretsus and the cross ownerships. That's where I learned about levitation and things like that. Anyway.
So part of this, frankly, is to revitalize that, to unlock hidden value, and again, to recreate some of that equity culture that Japanese households used to have. We've known them for most of our careers. Japanese households are savers. Okay, that's generally true. Given valuations still remain compelling on so many Japanese assets, the struggle is not going to be convincing global asset owners to put more capital to work in Japan. They're already convinced of that. And as has been revealed in the public domain, Larry Fink hosted a convention for BlackRock's 20 largest clients in Tokyo a couple of weeks back. You know, they didn't mean much convincing, but everyone came in to brief them from the Ministry of Trade and Industry, Kishida-san himself. They all came in, basically said, invest in Japan. That's actually the easy bit. You know, at some point, maybe the yen goes up, so you get a kicker there. The hard bit is lighting a fire under Japanese savers. That's the harder bit, convincing them that this is actually for real, you can take a little bit more risk. So to go back to Grant's point, if Japan is attempting a policy rate normalization because inflation's a little bit too high, it sounds bad, doesn't it? But if Japan's attempting a policy rate normalization because there's a whole bunch of other structural things happening, and policy normalization boosts the income for a time of Japanese households to begin with because they're all savers, doesn't that underwrite confidence and doesn't that sort of get households thinking that there might be better assets out there they can invest in? I don't know. But if Japan is hiking rates to catch up with the underlying economic realities in Japan, and let's just call it broadly structural reform, I'm not sure it's a huge negative for Japanese equities, although, of course, at the margin, it's probably a negative for JGBs. We know that. And there'll be a lot of people listening, incidentally, who say, oh, my gosh, what's going to be the mark-to-mark losses for all those people still holding JGBs when yields go up? Well, like everything, it depends. If those JGB holdings are offset even somewhat by a re-rating of Japanese equities, it helps people muddle through, and that's part of the gamble.
Especially the BOJ, right?
Right. All those ETFs they bought and stuff like that might turn out to be quite helpful. And, you know, there's some chat of a gigantic asset swap. Now, that would be super interesting.
Well, we discussed that at all of our prior meetings when the end game, which is now underway, it's not the end of the end game, but when it was the theory as to what the Japanese, to this day, I still don't know why they didn't swap all those JGBs they have for some 100-year-long piece of paper, but they missed that opportunity, I think.
I don't know, but to be clear, I'm talking about swapping their equity holdings for JGBs with other parties.
Oh, I see.
Now, that's a bit different, but that's been kicked around, but, you know, time will tell whether that's viable or not. But really, Grant, to get back to your question, as interesting as this potentially is for anyone looking at yen assets, I mean, obviously, and as much as we can envisage some kind of repricing of JGBs, all of which is reasonable, what we've got to think about is what are the global spillovers and how do incentives change, which I think is your point. How do incentives change for one of the world's most gigantic pools of savings? And what does it mean for the assets they've heretofore supported without question? Well, we're not leaping to a world where you can outperform in JGBs unhedged versus treasuries unhedged. We're not going straight to a world where every marginal dollar of Japanese savings says, I'm done with treasuries. We're not doing that. But we're on a journey here where the incentives change, where more of those marginal dollars of Japanese savings might feel incentivized to put money to work domestically, whether it be domestic fixed income and so forth. And it just erodes that marginal bid for longer term government bonds that I fear a lot of people have taken for granted. And to be clear, rightly so. You just assumed that Japan was mired in disinflation. If interest rates are going to be zero, of course Japanese savers are going to be putting a lot of capital to work around the world. But then the inverse is also true. If Japanese interest rates are not going to be zero for any reason, it's probably correct to think the Japanese savers will be putting marginally fewer dollars of savings to work in global capital markets. And need I remind you too that Japanese savers are absolutely fundamental to US structured credit. Absolutely fundamental. Whether it be our old friends at Norinchukin underwriting the senior tranche of the CLO market, the Japanese bank appetite for US structured credit in all forms to outrun yield. To be clear, as we can see from the spreads on the screen, we're a long way from Japanese savers or Japanese bank treasuries, et cetera, saying, hey, you know what? I now get a pickup on yen credit. We're not there yet, but the incentives change, the dynamics change, and the market clearing price for a lot of this stuff also changes if the Bank of Japan attempts a normalization cycle. And I want to be very clear to all our listeners, something's coming. And we need to pay attention to Japan in a way we've not paid attention for a long time. And I would argue that the possibility, and I'm choosing my words carefully, the possibility of a Bank of Japan normalization cycle, even the attempt of it, is probably more material for global bond markets and capital flows than a fist fight over whether 10-year JGBs are 80 or 90 or 100 basis points, et cetera, or 120 basis points.
That makes sense. And we've long keyed on the idea that the Bank of Japan are going to be so important in this turn into the end game, and it feels like the end game is underway now. It really does. I mean, wherever you look, whether it's the stuff we've talked about here or whether it's from a geopolitical perspective, there's something that's shifted in the world these last 2 years. And it's funny how that happens when higher cost of capital comes back, right, when inflation comes back. It's really weird how suddenly the things that no one's worried about for such a long time matter. And that's really what this is about, James, from talking to you and reading what you've had to say over the last 6 months, this idea that all these things matter and the lag, and we talk about policy lag, the lag seems to be, for my mind, the understanding that all these things matter again. People think everything is a flash in the pan, but it all matters, all of it.
Well, it's all tied together. It's all linked. We have a tightly coupled global financial system. We have tightly coupled global financial markets. We all know that. We can't look at any part of this in isolation. We have to think different. And there'll be any number of people, and I know this because I've spoken to a lot of people this year, it's like, oh my gosh, Japan's going to do that. Oh gosh, that's really, it's like, no. It is not automatically bad. It's different. It's different. And we need to dust off some frameworks that we last used a long time ago to understand what it means. Going back to that earlier point about the difference between nominal and real GDP, for example, the absence of indiscriminate price insensitive buyers of treasuries and, let's not forget, other government bond markets. You know, it's different. And if the Bank of Japan is going to embark on a hiking cycle, which I strongly sense they're going to have a swing at, then that further changes incentives, and it's the last stable variable. One of my long-standing clients loves to say, beware the stable variable. You know, back in 06, it was US house prices cannot go down. Whoops. Oh, in 07, it was we cannot have correlated defaults. Whoops. In 08, it was like a broker-dealer can't go bankrupt. I beg your pardon. And we're just teasing out and we're testing all these assumptions. But then again, we broke the glass on fiscal policy. We did direct fiscal transfers. So much of what's happening comes from that simple fact. And there's no obvious prospect of fiscal restraint. And that, plus inflation, that despite everyone trying ever so hard to predict it's topped, it's still way too high. It's still too sticky. And we need to keep an open mind about how it is that despite everything the Fed's done, for example, despite a Fed funds rate of 5.25% to 5.5%, let's say 5.35% effective rate, we're still wondering, are we there yet? And I'm not sure we are there yet. And even if the three of us had perfect knowledge on US personal consumption expenditures, nominal demand, the labor market over the next 3 months or during this current quarter, we thought, oh, geez, you know, this is really going to come down one or two handles of nominal GDP. Okay, maybe I do have a nibble at the long bond. That's fine. But you can't do that in isolation when the world's number one suppressant of long-term bond yields might be heading in a different direction. That's the point. And I know there's so many people that are out there saying, put on your tinfoil hat and do this, that, and the other. Okay. We know there's unfinished business. We know there's illiquidity in non-banks. We know that people have done desperately dumb things to take on a liquid exposure. We know all of that. And frankly, we'd be more surprised if a few people didn't get into big trouble. We know people have done really, really dumb things and eventually they'll pay the price if growth comes down back to the previous trend. We know all of that. But here we are in late 2023. And in the quarter just ended, nominal GDP in the United States was tracking around 7. I mean, that's striking. And to be clear, for everyone who's been kind enough to listen to us, if nominal GDP is somewhere between 5 or 6 or 7%, so 5 to 7%, bills get paid. It makes perfect sense that US credit, for example, in aggregate, yeah, spreads are out a bit, but they're well-behaved. Defaults are up a bit, yeah, but they're well-behaved. There's things that are going bump around the edges. Yes, they should be. They should be. But the conundrum for equities is that as much as we think, oh, my gosh, plug in a higher discount rate, pencil in some kind of more notable slowdown in 2024, all these things have to derate. Yes, 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 yes. But if the derating in growth is from high single digits back to the previous trend, say 4 to 5%, of course, given the concentration in the US equity market, in particular the Magnificent Seven, of course it's a very difficult headwind for those guys. Of course, in aggregate, indices are probably lower. But it's not automatic that it's the end of the world. It's not automatic. And the best businesses that you and I and our listeners can hopefully identify with already high free cash flow yields and all these other good things, good management, good balance sheets, there's plenty of them. They're going to be fine.
Yeah, perfect. We've come back full circle. I think it's the perfect place to finish. And look, we've been waiting to have this conversation for months, and I'm so glad we finally got to have it. This shift in Japan is something we've all three of us been watching for, and I think your point is absolutely right, and people need to listen to that. It's different. It's going to make the world different. And I'm biased because my career began in the Japanese equity markets in the 80s when Japanese equities going crazy was fabulously good for everybody, certainly around me.
And you were settling all your trades with a carrier pigeon or something, weren't you?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah. The ones we settled anyway. And, but you're right, James. The idea that this is automatically bad, it's going to bring change. It's going to bring an awful lot of change for sure. But that doesn't necessarily have to be bad if you understand it and can think it through and get ahead of it. So that the wisdom you've offered people in terms of how to think about it is invaluable.
So I think that it's very kind of you to say so. But the challenge for us all when everyone's full of rancor and asperity and jumping up and down and shouting and commenting on every 10 basis points and this, that, and the other, the challenge for all of us is to say, I'm not going to engage in any of that. I'm just going to sit and think and look out the window. And if in doubt, actually, this is what I should have said at the start. I say this to all these clients when I'm giving my presentations. If in doubt about the macro outlook, don't listen to me. Seriously, don't listen to me. In the first instance, what do you see outside? What do you see? And then to triangulate that, what are your best portfolio companies telling you in aggregate? You know, we see it in US financials earnings this week. Everyone's like, okay, let's look for the uptick in defaults. Oh, or let's look for the rollover in retail sales today. Oh. But if in doubt, don't listen to me. Listen to your best run companies in your portfolio, your best borrowers, or frankly, pay attention to who you think are the best run companies on earth. What are they seeing? What are they seeing in their businesses in real times, charge off defaults? What are they seeing? What are they doing? And the reason I flag that is because the world's best run businesses and their corporate commentary has been more right over the last 2 years than so much of the, oh my gosh, the world's ending kind of commentary that dominates macro discussions. Now, to be very clear to our listeners, at some stage next year, perhaps early next year, we're going to be doing another call on illiquidity across non-bank financial institutions. We're going to be doing a call on all the dumb shit people have done to keep up with the game, assuming that we were going to mean revert. There's a whole financial ecosystem built up around mean reversion. Oh, well, we get blips, but we know what the trend is. Lower yields, buy duration, get me more illiquidity. And all of that's up for grabs as well. And when you see these stories emerging about NAV lending and private equity, you're thinking, oh my gosh, and this is before we've had a recession. So to be clear, an investor in a private equity fund borrows something like 30 to 40% LTV at a rate of 11 or 12% to get their cash out of a private equity fund. And this is before we've had a recession. What other dumb shit have people done that we're yet to expose? And I think the challenge for all of us imagining next year is to not lose our head when all of this blows up. When all this illiquidity in non-banks and stupid things asset allocators have done, as tempting as it is to join the throng, and we can imagine already and say the world's ending, you know, tin food and this, that, and the other. Actually, the smart thing to do is to say, actually, I know that asset. It's a great asset. It's just held by a very weak hand. That's going to be the challenge. But look, I'm imagining 2024, but it's really nice to see you both. I'm glad we could connect and sketch out some scenarios here. But I think, look, we go back to that January 2022 analogy. Imagine the three of us are having a chat in January 22. We nail all the hikes. We nail this, that, and the other. I reckon if we imagined in late 23, we had a Fed funds rate, effective rate of, let's say, 535, we would have imagined much more obvious signs of a slowdown in consumption, rising unemployment, tighter financial conditions in general, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not happening. Even allowing for lags, it's not happening. And I think the burden is on all of us to just keep our minds open and think a bit differently about what's actually happening here.
Amen. Mate, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic, as always. Thank you so much for doing this and giving up your time on a, what is it, Tuesday evening?
I don't know what day it is, and I don't even know where I am, but there we are. But it's absolute pleasure, as always. And at one level, I hope we never find what the end game is, because then there'll be no more podcasts.
Oh, no, we start a new podcast called The New Game, but then I've already figured that out.
Yeah.
We've already figured it out.
We're way ahead of you, mate.
You guys.
All right, matey. Listen, look after yourself and travel safe, and try and get some rest in between all those flights you're taking.
Yeah, I'll do my best, but I appreciate your time, and I thank everyone for listening.
Good lad. Thanks, matey. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. I need to lie down. That BOJ thing, you know, you and I have talked a little bit offline with James about this, which is why we were so keen to have a chat with him. And he's right. I mean, talk about upset the apple cart. If that is where the BOJ go, and he's right, I don't think people have any understanding of how much that changes things.
No. And what sounds sort of interesting is, you know, basically trying to leave NERP, ZERP, QE, and all these things should be quite painful. So far, the pain's mostly been in the bond market here and maybe some of the banks. And we did look at the sunny side of the story. I just wonder if there won't be some negatives in Japan as well, but I don't know what they will.
Undoubtedly.
I don't know what they are. But so anyway, once they start the process, it's going to be going on for quite a while. So that's the thing. I don't think you have to jump the gun. You just got to wait till they start it.
Yeah. No, I agree. And you know, the other central banks have, I think, shown that if the Bank of Japan get going, they will, like all the others, go for longer and go farther than everybody expects them to. And so you do have that tailwind for a period of time. Well, mate, I'm going to go and have a dinner with my father. It's been an absolute pleasure to see you. And our thanks, as always, to James Aitken for joining us. He's been a regular guest on the show, and every single one of his appearances has been absolutely phenomenal. If you don't know his website, you should go and check it out, aitkenadvisors.com. James does just truly extraordinary work. And you will also find him on Twitter, at aitkenadvisors. You can follow me. If you're not doing so, you'll find me at TTMYGH.
And I'll be at FleckCap.
He's here all week. Don't forget to tip your waitress. Bill, I will see you again soon, my friend. Take care of yourself.
Alrighty, great.
Nothing we discussed during the end game should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.